Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts. As some of you may know, we've been on Pitt Street for almost 200 years, and just a blink of an eye when one considers the traditional custodians of this land. And so to begin, I'd like to start by acknowledging the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and acknowledging their connection to this coastline and its reach. Oh my goodness. It's been a long day, and its rich ecosystem, which stretches back thousands of years. We thank them for their ongoing care, and we pay our deepest respects to elders past, present, and emerging. So a little bit of housekeeping before we begin. Please, if you haven't done so already, please switch your phone off or set them to silent. If you're new here, the bathrooms are through the doors, and it's stage right. There will be a Q&A session after this. The format usually is just to pop your hand up and I'll jog over to you with a microphone. And after the discussion, Michelle will be available to sign copies of Baron Cape and Rush. So don't rush off. Right, so thank you all for braving this damp autumn evening. We're so happy that you're here. And we're especially glad to welcome two very special guests for a conversation about a very special book. I am delighted to introduce tonight's speakers, Michelle Prack and Catherine Dubelu-Ménager. I'm sorry if I butcher that, Catherine. Michelle is no stranger to storytelling. She has a background in PR, social media, and university lecturing, and she spent years helping others shape their message. And now with her latest thriller, Baron Cape, she is taking the centre stage as an author in her starring author in her own right. In conversation tonight with her is the ever-insightful Catherine. She is an interviewer, the Bad Festival curator, and someone with an uncanny ability to draw out the heart of a story. So when Catherine tells you there's a book you need to read it. In my case, you need to contact the publicist. So thank you, Jasmine, for the advance copy. The book is absolutely amazing. It's set in a remote coastal town with a sinister edge. It's tense, it's atmospheric, and deeply unsettling, and it kept me up until 3 a.m. I won't give anything away, but Michelle, I absolutely love the way that you wove real-world issues through this fictional world. It was seamless, compelling, and I found myself forgetting it wasn't real. So if you haven't read the book, it's available in our library, or you can buy a copy from our friend Julia from Three Sparrows. So without further ado, I'll stop stumbling over words and I'll put a hand over to the wordsmith, Michelle and Catherine. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everybody, for coming out today on this very appallingly wet day. I know we need rain, but just not always at the moment when you want to do something else. But thank you very much. The book Baron Cape was published, how many, 3 weeks ago?
Yeah, about 3 weeks.
And so this is its Sydney first Sydney outing, its Sydney launch, and thank you for being here. Now, Michelle, I thought we'd start by finding out a bit more about you. You've worked in journalism, in PR, in social media, so really words have always been part of your life, words and writing, is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think the audience already knows a little bit about me by the enormous white sneakers that you can see on stage. I didn't think they'd have such a prominent position when I put them on this morning, but they've been super handy on the wet Sydney streets. Thanks for coming out today. It's lovely to see you. So as you mentioned, my background has been in writing for many decades. I've been a PR practitioner, a social media consultant, a chief of staff for a politician, and always writing has been the backbone of that work. But like a lot of authors, I always wanted to be a writer since I was a child, since primary school.
Really? A fiction writer.
Fiction writer, yeah, absolutely. And though I enjoy writing, for all sorts of forms, as I've had to in that career. But I was also a person that was very interested in being able to put food on the table and being able to pay my mortgage. So I studied a journalism degree and eventually went into PR, as I say, just thinking that fiction writing would be something I'd come to one day, and I finally have.
Well, that's all the better for us, actually. How did you start to write fiction, or did you always write a bit?
When I was younger, how did I start?
What's your journey of fiction through fiction been?
All right, terrific. Well, I suppose the journey really does begin with reading. So being a voracious reader as a child, I was someone that always had a nose in a book. And I was encouraged by teachers at school. I was very lucky to have that encouragement. They gave me so many opportunities to write, but also to air that work. So, for example, teachers used to read chapters of my work out, my work to the rest of the class. Mm-hmm. I wrote a play in year seven, so all of those lovely opportunities came about. And then as I went through my teens, I started submitting short stories to various journals. Mm. I also dabbled in writing columns. I got a column and published in Dolly magazine.
Whoa, that was fabulous.
The funny thing about that is I was paid $100, and that would still be a good check today for a writer.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It is. That was fun. But I suppose fiction writing was very much on the back burner, as I've mentioned, and as my 50th birthday was looming, I reminded myself, Michelle, you've always wanted to
be... This is what you want to do.
Yep, yeah, you've always wanted to be a novelist. When are you going to get into gear and get this done?
And you wrote a short story that won a prize, is that right?
I was runner-up in the Furphy Literary Prize. Yeah, but that was
pretty good. It's a prestigious short story competition. So how did you go from there? What did you do at that point?
I've always loved short stories, actually. So I had a story published in Mianjin when I was a teenager as well, and various other journals, a lot of them closed now. Yeah. But I think one of the things about the short story form, if you look back at that work, it had similar themes to the themes in the Russian Barren Cape, and perhaps there was a little thriller element to some of those short stories as well. There was a bit of a cliffhanger nature in some of those. But when I did set my sights on finally trying to complete a novel, I actually dabbled in a completely different genre. I decided that I'd go for rom-coms. And I was going through a patch where I was really enjoying reading that genre, and it seemed to be energising and fun. And so I wrote and self-published three novels in that genre, and then decided that that wasn't really where my heart lay, that I did want to move into thrillers. And that's when I began working on The Rush.
Were you a big thriller reader as well?
Yes, I was. I used to read all sorts of genres, thrillers. Dystopian books were a big favourite of mine for a long time as well. But when it comes to all sorts of content, for example, movies and TV, thrillers is what I've been drawn to most. Yeah.
So you've done those three books, but now you're thinking, I want to write a thriller. How did you go about it? Did you get an agent? Did you submit manuscripts? How did you?
Yeah, so I worked on The Rush for quite a long time. I knew, well, with my self-published books, for example, I did try to get them traditionally published. Mm. So I knew that there was a certain standard I wasn't quite meeting. So I worked incredibly hard on The Rush for something like 18 months, maybe even longer. And then I submitted it to agents and eventually found a Melbourne agent who took me on, and I was very lucky because this agent had a background in editing as well, and so that's a delightful double whammy. Mm. And she helped me polish The Rush and, eventually start pitching it, and Simon & Schuster picked it up.
So as I was saying earlier, when The Rush came out, the marketing director at Simon & Schuster said, "Catherine, I've got a book for that. I've got a book for your Writers Festival. You must have it." And I thought, okay, right, I will do that. And that's the kind of person you want in your corner. And that went really well, didn't it, The Rush, for you?
Yeah, I was delighted,
Yeah, it was really good. And in fact, I run the Bad Sydney Crime Writers Festival, and we try to have as many debut writers as we can, because if you don't start somewhere, nobody's ever going to know you. So you have to get that opportunity. And you went on a panel, which was really good. So that was The Rush. Did you immediately start to write Barren Cape, or was there a bit of a...
Oh, yeah, I was working on other manuscripts, but I did experiment quite a bit. So there were other manuscripts I've left in my wake, other thrillers that I was working on while The Rush was making its way out into the public. A lot of them, though, I abandoned because they weren't giving me that zing, that excitement that I needed, that passion to keep on with them, so I'd put them to one side. And that was quite substantial. Some of them were like 20, 30, 40,000 words, but it's not worth persevering. You have to be honest with yourself as a writer. You know, if I'm not in love with it, I can't make other people fall in love with it. But after some time, I did come to the story that eventually became Barren Cape. So, yes, always writing as soon as The Rush was sold, but on all sorts of projects.
Yeah. Now, Barren Cape is very different, from The Rush. It's a kind of thriller. But we were saying earlier, I like to categorize books. Is it this kind of crime book? Is it a police procedural? Is it a spy story? And I was trying really hard, and I thought, well, yes, it's a thriller, but it's so much more than a thriller, because the thrill is one of the points, but it's not the only point. So this is a really extraordinary book which deals with a lot of social issues, but through a very good story and through thriller genre, rather than, it's not in any way lectury, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's so successful. So it's looking at family breakdown, the consequences of family breakdown, isolation, and the lack of affordable or secure housing, and also a society that is full of victims, or full of casualties is a better word, really strongly full of casualties. What drove you to write this book? What triggered you?
Well, I have been, and this might sound dry, I have been interested in housing for quite some time.
Is that your political background?
not so much. But I grew up in a South Australian regional town called Whyalla. Hands up if you've heard of Whyalla, if you've been. Oh, terrific, terrific. So you know it was a steel mining town and still is, but very much struggling. And as I've made an author's note that explains a little bit of this in the back of Barren Cape, but I grew up in government housing, and all of my family were in government housing, and a lot of them, we survived on welfare for much of my youth. And I always took it for granted that there would be that safety net, that there'd always be a brick three-bedroom home no matter what we were going through and whether we were working or not. And as I went through high school and saw friends dropping out of high school and signing up for the dole, they moved into three-bedroom houses. The government always had that protection, or that, as I've said, that safety net for them. So that's something that I've somewhat, I suppose, have taken for granted. Not that I've ever lived it that way since I graduated from university, but I did know that agencies like the South Australian Housing Trust were so important. However, over decades, you know, the government has moved out of government housing and has shed the housing stock. So there's tens of thousands of houses lost to public housing in South Australia. So while that's been something I'm aware of, there was something else in the zeitgeist which all of you would be aware of, is this rental crisis that we have now, the home ownership crisis. And when I started working on Barren Cape a couple of years ago, part of me even wondered if this crisis might be almost fixed, that we'd have a solution.
That would be nice.
But instead, we've seen it grow worse and worse and worse. And so the themes in Barren Cape are still very prevalent. And, yeah, so it's a little bit of my history sparked the interest, as well as just generally keeping an eye on current affairs.
In the world, yeah. So set up the story for us, set up the book for us. So there's three points of view in this book, it's seen through three different characters' eyes. And they're all women. And in fact, one of the things is you do write fabulous women. I mean, you write good men too, but you write really good women. So there's Mac, there's Erica, and there's Brex. Mac and Erica are similar ages. Brex is younger, like 10 years younger, 8 years younger, and that makes a huge difference. You'd think 8 years, but it's like they're different, completely different generations, almost. So tell us a bit about MAC first.
Yep, terrific. So MAC is short for Mackenzie, and she's a 22, 23-year-old university dropout. She did one semester of uni and found it wasn't quite right for her. She thinks that she might go back but hasn't quite worked out what she'll do. So in the meantime, she holds down two casual jobs, one at a gym where she also works out. So Mackie is a bodybuilder. She's a weightlifter. She loves bodybuilding. And she also has a job in a cafe. And so it's not the most salubrious of incomes, but she has enough money to pay the rent. And she is, at the beginning of the book, in any case, sharing a flat with her good friend Erica. Mac really is the protagonist of the book. It's all about the issues that she faces. She is the epicenter that brings the other characters
with
her.
Her journey, really. Yeah. So she and Erica are living together, and what happens?
The dear landlord decides not to renew their lease because, and they find weeks later that it's being listed as an Airbnb.
Yeah, she tells them she's going to sell it, and that. I don't know about you, but that really rings a bell with me. People who say, no, no, you need to leave. But it turns up again with a higher rent. For whatever reason, that's not been possible. So what do they do? What, you know, they do what we'd all do, I think. Go and look for somewhere to live.
Yeah, that's right. So while the countdown is on, they've got a few weeks to vacate. They start turning up for rental inspections, signing on, applying for homes, but they're unsuccessful again and again and again because the queues, the waiting lists are simply too long. The environment, the rental property market is too competitive.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember what Erica does. Is she a she works in a bar.
Yeah, she studies online at university, but she works at a nightclub
as
well.
That's right. Yeah. And they search and search, but in the end,
nada.
Nada. And so what happens?
Yeah, so luckily for Erica, she can go back to the family home. Her parents have a larger home. Two of her brothers are still there, and so she goes back to her old childhood bedroom. But for Mac, that it's not so straightforward. Her father lives overseas. She does live with her mother in a small flat for a little while, but they soon part ways. And that's because they don't have a very healthy or happy relationship. They can't live under one roof. And this happens sometimes with families. If you think you can rely on them, it's not always the case. You just, for whatever reason, do not get on. So Mac starts to couch surf for weeks and weeks. She just relies on the kindness of friends, and she feels like a terrible burden, as you would, I'm sure you can imagine. It's really hard, and it grates on everyone's friendships. And Mac is a character that's also quite introverted and independent, so this is really difficult for her to be in the way, sleeping in lounge rooms, having her friends live their lives around her.
And you make a really good point that having somewhere to live, not necessarily your own home, but having a room at least, is really important for being an adult. Mm. And that if you don't have that, then you've sort of failed. You've had to go home.
Yeah, absolutely. And Mac exhausts all sorts of other avenues as well. And I'm sure if this happened to any of us, we'd have a list of what we could possibly do. So, for example, she does investigate whether she could put up a tent at a caravan park. And guess what? No Adelaide metropolitan caravan parks would let you do that. You can do it in the countryside or in the regionals, but for you know, her purposes, they will not let someone live in a tent in the caravan park. One night she sleeps in her car.
Quite scary. That's a really scary experience.
Just and that is part of her private introverted character. She just craves that solitude just for one night where she doesn't have to make small talk or make nice with friends. And she sleeps at a motel for one night as well and so on. And actually goes onto websites trying to discover, is she officially homeless? Because it takes a while for this to occur to her, because she feels like, you know, that a rental was going to arrive at any time. But to actually go to a government website and tick the criteria was quite confronting for her. Mm. But at the same time, realising there's still no services or help. Yes, you might be officially homeless, but there's no shelter for you.
So there's no three-bedroom brick house where
No more.
There's nothing and there's no hope. So I don't know. I've never experienced homelessness. Yeah. I don't know if any of you have. But or precarious housing, you know, you're okay, but it might drop at any minute. Mm. It's a very demoralizing process.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's what drives her to take these, really risky choices. It's what pushes her out to Barron Cape. So what she ends up doing is she goes for a coastal drive and discovers this abandoned construction site.
Looking a bit like that. Great.
Yes. With an empty swimming pool, but still you've got the lovely sea there. So she goes for a coastal drive and finds an abandoned resort. It's abandoned after the COVID era. We remember all the travel fell over, all the travel bans. And so the international investors have effectively just left it sitting there mothballed. But it fascinates her. She didn't realise it was there. It's in a little remote cove and location, and it presents hundreds of empty rooms. So when night falls, she decides to break in.
Do you want to read that first part?
Okay. And I might hold it far away because I've just begun to wear glasses. But I'm at that stage where I forget to pack them. Okay, so this is Mac, and it is the opening chapter. When the sun sank, the resort became a museum of dark shadow, and although the night remained warm, the breeze gathered strength, scattering leaves and rushing through crevices. Far away, the security gates rattled, and other random clinking rang over the empty construction site. My nerves were only slightly calmed by the pounding of the nearby waves, a reassuring white noise. I wondered, was I a genius or a fool? If I was discovered, if this was reported to the police and became public, my friends, family and workmates would find out. It'd be devastating. I imagined my humiliation, the confusion on people's faces. What happened to Mac? Did you hear? Some might find this setup daunting, nerve-wracking, foolish, breaking and entering and sleeping alone on the outskirts of the city. Yet for me, it was worth the risk. Worth it for the independence, the privacy and the quiet. There was no landlord, no neighbours, no hosts, no creeps. Nobody I was forced to make small talk with. I was in charge. There were also no locks on the doors. Instead, I jammed a rubber stopper under mine to help secure it. Did it mean my new room was impenetrable? No. But what place truly was.
Hmm. So what could go wrong? Or what's not going to... Well,
and then it becomes very cosy.
And you describe really well how she manages to create a little home, really. And that works for a bit. But then I really don't want to give anything away. But as you can imagine, things go wrong. And they go wrong because of other people. Erica is at home with her mother, but comes to have a look and gets involved. Can you say anything about that? Because their relationship is quite interesting too.
Yeah, that's right. I had a lot of fun with these two friends. Because really they're only very close because they were forced to be close as flatmates. And so that's an interesting thread. Erica is very different to Mac. She's much more extroverted. She's optimistic and energetic. And she has fallen in love with a DJ. And that DJ is also having accommodation issues. So Erica thinks Barron Cape might be a solution for her as well. And in thinking of that, she lets Mac down.
Yeah. She comes from a more privileged background.
Absolutely. She's a little bit more comfortable. And in fact, Mac does sleep on Erica's bedroom floor from time to time as well.
When she needs to.
Yeah, that's it. It's another fallback.
Another fallback.
She hates.
Yeah. So I was saying to you earlier, so Mac it does actually have a family. Her father lives overseas. And I think he, does he suggest she might want to come or, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
But she doesn't want to.
No, she doesn't want to disrupt his life, no. Yeah.
And she does go and stay with her mother. And I was quite shocked, I suppose. You know, when you read a book and you think, I would never do that. Or why did you do that? So the mother basically is very, doesn't want her there. And tell us a bit about that. You were saying...
She doesn't. I was saying it would be a delightful book for Mother's Day. So just bear that in mind if you are gifting it on Mother's Day.
Yes, just...
Erica's mother's lovely. She's very warm and welcoming, and she doesn't mind how much of her brood is still at home. But, yeah, Mac has a really difficult relationship with her mother, and now we descend into the psychotherapy session for tonight.
Yes.
This was loosely inspired by myself returning to Whyalla. So I spent years in Adelaide going to university, and then I got this fantastic job with the local politician. Had to move back to the hometown and, of course, knocked on my own mother's door to stay with her for a while. And she was very happy in her house by herself. Let me in, of course, to stay. But we went through the same thing that Mac and her mother Sandy went through, though this is fictionalised and amped up for thriller purposes. But, yeah, we didn't get along, and it wasn't... as some people might expect, a fact where you might be able to stay with your parent for as long as you like, and that's completely fine. I did find myself moving out very shortly afterwards and living with friends until I found my own accommodation. And luckily, this was in the early 90s and it wasn't an issue to find accommodation. There was plenty of rental properties for me, but I was just looking for accommodation in that stopgap. So that really was the inspiration and the nub of what I created with Mac and her mother. And it's one of the ways that I know as well that it's very credible and authentic. You know, you'll have some family members that welcome you with open arms, but some who just want to remind you, you're an adult now, I'm living my best life now, please don't come back.
And that's very real. And what do you do? Yes, I was just saying, what would I do? You know, I suppose, I don't know. What would my mother say if I turned up?
And what you do now is very different from, as I said, what you do back then. It was, we're in a whole different era now where the risks are higher for younger people and people of all ages.
That's right. So she's, that's a really important, but the other thing, though, is that relationship is not just... It's not just a stereotyped relationship because it, in fact, involves throughout the book. And I thought that was really good. Is that real life as well? Did you reconcile a bit with your mother?
No, it went very, very, very differently.
Yeah, anyway. But that is really, that's really nice. And Mac is the kind of person who doesn't ever give up. She has plans. And I think we can talk about her plan. That's not going to... So... what does she decide to do?
Yeah, well, she's had enough of Australia. Her sister lives in London, so Mac realises, I don't have a lease. Why am I hanging about here? And I'm young, and isn't travel part of being young? So she makes plans to go to London. So, you know, when she does set up and actually begin squatting at Barron Cape, it's still a very temporary proposition. So that's one of the reasons, I suppose, that she can... push herself to do it because she knows it's short term and that she has exciting plans on the horizon if her visa will come through.
And she can get away, yeah.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. But so it's not just that she has nowhere to live, she's being stalked or harassed at work. Mm. And that's, you draw that out really well too, because tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I'm glad you've mentioned that. So as I've said, Mac works in a gym, and so one of the other things that I've thrown into her world, as well as making her homeless, I've given her a stalker. she works in a gym and finds herself under the gaze of some unwanted attention. It's a new gym member who asks her out and is quite persistent, doesn't really understand her rejections, and so... He's a character whose threat level rises throughout, and it's kind of part of a menacing mix through Baron Cape. But again, I think it is a realistic social issue, and it happens to a lot of people that go to a gym of both sexes, that you can be the focus of unwanted attention in this, you know, world of mirrors where everybody also has their phone.
Yeah, and where you... You don't, I mean, she, there's nothing that she's done to make this happen, even if that was a thing.
She tries to shut it down again and again.
From the very beginning. But it doesn't work. So that's yet another layer of complexity in her life. Erica, meanwhile, has a kind of a much easier life. But there's a third character who I was found challenging as well. She's a young woman called Brex. And tell us a bit about her. She's... As I said to begin with, she's about 8, 9 years younger.
Yeah. She's 14.
No, less than that then, 6 years younger.
Yeah.
Five, yeah.
She's 14, but, you know, she thinks she's 44. She's pretty tough. So Brex actually is the only character that does live locally to Baron Cape. She lives in a beachside suburb, a lower socioeconomic suburb, and she's a few bus rides away from the beach. She's a truant, so she often ditches school, and this beach has been a haven for her and her two best friends for quite some time. There's a cave there where they hang out. They have campfires. If it's really hot, they'll go for a swim. Brex has a really problematic home life. It's quite tough. She can't rely on it either. I promise I don't only write bad mothers.
Her mother's not too hot either. No, but her mother's not a bad person. She just...
Oh, that's right. She's busy. She's a single mother. Yeah. She's got three children. She works. And in her world, Brex is at an age where she should be self-sufficient. And in fact, should look after her younger brothers. But, yeah, I like Brex because she's spunky. She's a survivor. She does what she needs to. She even says that there's only one thing she will get an A-plus in, and that is shoplifting. So she's very proud of that. She's got her favourite little nook in Woolworths, a favourite pillar that she hides behind where she puts merchandise down her jeans.
But she's another person who doesn't give up. She'll never give up, Rex. She just... She carries on. Mm. And she's... But that even she has another... So she has this insecure family situation. Is her father mentioned? I'm trying.
No, he's not mentioned at all. But yeah, it's this the threat of the mother's boyfriend returning to town. Yeah.
So the mother has a boyfriend who's gone at the beginning of the book, but then whoopsie.
Yeah.
Reappears.
Unwelcome.
Very unwelcome.
And another great character name. Do you remember his name?
Oh no, I don't actually.
Shithead.
Oh, yeah, but that's not his actual name, is it? No. No, but she calls him that, yeah.
That's effectively that's the character name. I think
she's mentioned
in one scene, Brex's mother says, don't call him that, his name's Michael.
But, yeah, I think Shithead's a bit better, really. There's a very, very funny scene, which I'll tell anyway. I mean, I don't think it doesn't give up anything. She's there with a friend making dinner and this guy turns up. And says, I've come back, you know, hi, I'm here. Mm. Where's my dinner? And so they give him some of their dinner, but she spits in it because he's so horrible, which is a very petty form of revenge, but really...
That is Brex. That is her, yeah.
Yeah, she's just, like, she's powerless, but she's not quite powerless. Mm. And she also gets involved in Baron Cape. So you've got these three stories coming together. There's Mac, who's ended up there because she's got nowhere else to be. There's Erica and the sort of homeless, but not whatever, the boyfriend, the DJ boyfriend.
More of a happily homeless, I suppose.
Yeah, and kind of slightly druggy and happy-go-lucky. And then there's Brex and her friends, who are very vulnerable as well. In fact, everybody in this book is vulnerable. Which is not uncommon.
No, that's right. Especially the suburbs that I'm basing Brex on, so that they are the southern suburbs of Adelaide where there are a lot of societal challenges. But I've mentioned before that I follow the media, and you know, stories in the news can often be inspiring, and they're very sobering as well. But you know, but people of 14, 15 years of age are very capable of committing violent crimes. And at the time, as I was sort of fleshing out Brecht's, in the background, there were terrible stories of young girls and what they'd done to their grandmothers for money, violence against grandmothers. So it was that those sort of elements, I suppose, that I did put into her, because she is desperate. She is scrapping for a living. She's a
cop doesn't do anything artist. To her grandmother.
No, she doesn't
have a grandmother. Oh, we don't know.
No grandmothers yeah. involved. So, but they're sort of the seeds of inspiration that also reminded me that it was still grounded in reality, which is sometimes what makes a thriller even more scary, because it does feel like, yes, this could happen or this is happening.
Yeah, so it's not, you know, the evil figure from somewhere else necessarily. It's very much rooted in real life, which makes it all the more frightening, I think, as you say. But Baron Cape itself is almost a character. It tells a bit more about the place, and it's really well drawn. I don't know if you've ever been to a derelict place, and it has a personality and a soul of its own.
So a few of you said you've been to Whyalla before. Have you been to the Fleurieu Peninsula? And that's places like Maslin, Moana, Aldinga Beach. Oh, yeah, terrific. So this, yeah, is based on the Fleurieu. So it's like a half-hour drive from Adelaide at the most. Beautiful coastline. Yeah, isn't it? That's right, exactly. And we're very lucky as well in that a lot of people haven't discovered it or don't take the time to come there. So it's really peaceful and tranquil, and you think what a miracle it is to have these lovely beaches to yourself. It is the landscape's inspired by that, and in particular a smaller beach that my family and I went to for annually for quite a long time, and that I just love to be in. And Baron Cape is based on that because it's a kind of location that can't be overrun by suburbia, because it's hemmed in by these cliffs and hills. It just makes things too hard. And so it's fabulous how that little cove has been able to exist on its own without being overrun. And it has that isolated quality. And that's what I based Baron Cape on. However, I couldn't have Baron Cape being too lovely and pretty, because it would have a lot of beachgoers. So I mixed in these ingredients from other South Australian beaches, where, for example, Baron Cape has a lot of seaweed and slippery rocks and things that just make it a little bit more difficult to access the water and make it, yeah, stir in some of those creepy elements, I suppose. But I do love the cover and how faithful the designer was to this sort of vegetation that you find along that part of the coast. Mm. I'm always taking photographs of it.
So is there an actual place?
No, there's no abandoned place. There's Don't go looking place. For it. No.
Yeah. We won't go and search. Okay. That won't be a prize if we find it. So tell us how you write. Do you have the entire story in your head, or do you make it up as you go along?
I have a lot of it in my head. I just get the spark of the idea. So with The Rush, for example, that I wanted to write about a road trip that doesn't end well. With Baron Cape, I knew very much I wanted to have... I had the whole picture of a young woman in peril, cannot find safety and security anywhere else, has to break into a place on the beach and then... compete for that place with other people. Mm. I sort of had the nub of that really, really quickly, and then had to work on fleshing out what it all meant.
And did you know because some writers write so... They basically write the book before they write the book, as far as I could make out. We were talking about Candice Fox earlier, and she doesn't do that, but she writes with James Patterson, and other writers basically have chapter by chapter mapped out. So a lot of work goes on before, and then the writing is sort of filling it in, really. Did you know what was going to happen in the end?
I do like to have a roadmap, so I do sketch it out. So I'm more of the planner, but I don't quite know what's going to happen in the end of the final manuscript, if you know what I mean. I'm open to changes and twists. That's definitely what happened with the rush. It was something like draft 12 where I realised this massive twist I could develop. So with Baron Cape, this is still how I approach it. I think I know the ending and I know roughly what I want to happen, but creativity still takes place during all that drafting. But I must say that I do like to have something to aim towards. I do like to have the feeling that I know how each chapter is going to unfold, because that helps me defeat writer's block. Because I've got the plan. That helps me defeat the plan. So I don't get writer's block because I've already had, if you like, a big brainstorming period where I've got my plan, and now it's just a matter of going to the desk and
writing it,
fleshing that out day by day. But it's like the plan is something that holds your hand. You know, every day when you go to the keyboard, you're not starting from scratch. You're not trying to pull ideas from the ether. That I've already done all that in my brainstorming and plotting time, and now I'm just stitching it together and helping it come to life.
So you had that when you sat down. Do you still have a day job, or is this your day job?
I still have a day job, but it's supremely flexible. So I teach at uni online, and most of them at my own hours. So a lot of it's grading work, for example. But again, that's one reason why I left writing to so late in life, because I was in a more secure and stable position to have casual work or part-time work. So, you know, I don't have that full-time corporate career that I used to.
Yeah.
So writing, I can really fit in hours every day.
You can do it. I'm just trying, it's a long time since I read Rush, and I'm just trying to remember, it's a road trip, but where is it set?
They begin in Adelaide, and their idea is they're going to drive from Adelaide to Darwin.
And so both your books take place in South Australia. Mm. Do you think you'll move interstate? Any chance?
Well, book three does come into New South Wales.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So I'm bringing the danger over here.
Thank you. That's great.
It's not just South Australian tourism I'm damaging. No. I'm doing it all.
You're doing it, yeah. So book three is on its way, is it?
Yeah. I've drafted it many times. I think it's in a good shape. My agent, it thinks it's in a good shape, so now I have to see if the publisher agrees.
One of the things that the problem with writers is that you have to spend a lot of time when you bring out a book to promote it. It's a lot of work, and some people say that they can't write for a few months because they just haven't got the time. Do you make the time, or do you manage that?
Yeah, I suppose that's an advantage of my background in PR, that I don't feel like it. It is a lot of work, so it really doesn't change my timetable too much at all, and I do try to stay in touch with my manuscript. I'm the kind of writer that if I leave it for a while, it'll be so hard to get back into, so I try to stay in touch with it every day, even if it's only half an hour.
Can you write in a cafe, or do you have to be in a cork-lined room, you know?
I can, but I'd rather not. I'd rather be at home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Music?
No, I don't like any of that. I'm just, you know, whatever neighbourhood noise is going on is fine, but I'm not a person that listens to music. I'm really fascinated by those authors who might, for example, have a certain soundtrack or a theme that helps influence their writing, and I can see how that would work, but really I have everything switched off and I'm just bashing the keyboard. Yeah.
And when you start to create your characters, do you visualize them, but do you kind of have images? Do you have a board where you have pictures of people they could look like?
Yes. Yeah, I do grab images from the web, but in my book I don't tend to describe their physical characteristics. I'm not sure if you noticed that.
Yeah, you don't.
A little for some people that where it matters, but really I've left it up to readers. So you could all be imagining very, very different people. So I have, you know, a little pieces of art, I suppose, just to keep me on track. Whatever I've imagined, I've found that person. And I have a few dot points as well, just to remind me of their characteristics. So I don't do big character maps, but just a few touch points. As I've mentioned here, for example, Mac is introverted. That's the touch point for her. Brex is fierce. Brex isn't afraid to ask you for $50. So some of those dot points just to keep me on track, especially with two characters like Mac and Erica who are the same age and background and could meld together. So I need to look now and again and make sure that these are different, authentic people.
Yeah, they're very different characters. It's interesting. When you read a book, I don't know what you're like, but sometimes you're given a lot of information about they're tall, they're thin, they're fat, they're blonde, they're dark. Now, I saw Mac as dark-haired and... Isn't that interesting?
I did not say that.
Yeah, no, it's just how I see her. And sort of tallish. Do you have a...
Well, we know she's well-built because she's a bodybuilder.
She's a bodybuilder.
So that's a given. And that's one of the things that she does with her characters. She assesses people. She'll observe them and say, you know, his lats are terrible. He's got no calves at all.
But Erica, I see, is blonde and sort of prettier. Don't ask me why. But that is interesting. So and the great thing about reading as opposed to watching something on television is that you put every, you know, you just imagine. You can create what you want to create. So what's your relationship with your characters? Do you regret them when you leave them?
Yeah, I'm in love with all of them, even, you know, as flawed as they are. So it's so fascinating to hear readers talk about them. Some reviews, they're not getting the characters aren't getting a lot of love. And I'm like, what's not to love about this little thief? Why don't you like her? And then I realise, of course. She does so many challenging things. She hurts people. But to me, they're part of this wacky, I guess, dysfunctional family. I really like them and like being in their company.
Could you ever see yourself, by the way, if you've got any questions, start to think because I'll give you a chance to ask them. Do you ever think that you could take your characters from one book to the next? Have you ever even considered doing that?
Yeah, I have debated that a lot actually with book three because one of the characters is just such a rollicking adventure and she's such a strong character and it's somewhat of a cliffhanger position that I've left her in that I think it could easily slide into being, you know, in another, at least another book. But I'm daunted by the challenges of that, you know, the pros and cons of serialising someone, for example. I'm still thinking about that.
Yeah, and that's a big thing in crime fiction. You get the same detective or the same, And just tell us a bit about what kind of crime you read. Or do you read crime? Do you read other things?
You know, I'm very much a thriller reader. So as you've mentioned, you know, Candace Fox, I've read a lot of hers. She's a real inspiration to me. The thing I like about Candace's books are things, I suppose, that I'm trying to lean into in that they're more sort of action-based, where people really have to look after themselves. And I suppose that's the difference between crime and thrillers as well. I've always called myself a thriller writer because there's no police presence, there's no detective work. These people are thrown into the deep end and they're not, emergency services aren't on hand for them. I like them to be solving their own dangerous situations. But as well as Candace, I'm a big fan of Gabriel Bergmosa, who is a similar action-packed thriller streak.
I find him terrifying.
Oh, it's so good. He's got a series called The Hunted. That is bloodthirsty, though.
Yeah, there's too much.
These aren't bloody. Yeah. They're bloodthirsty.
There's a lot of violence in his.
That's right, yeah.
Big stereotype here. He's more male writer for me. I mean, he does happen to be a male, I think that's... Candace is an interesting writer. I think Candace is a kind of Brex, really, but a nice Brex. As a person,
yeah,
I don't know if you ever...
She's got that energy. Yeah, good call.
She'll have a great book next year. And she just is a... She's a really unusual and fabulous person, but not somebody who ever gives up anything. Mm. So, that's interesting. You might take somebody forward, but you might not.
I'll probably be too scared to in the end. Yeah. Too hard.
So, Candice, what about other crime, Gabriel Bergman?
Yeah, so I do try to read Australian crime and thrillers as much as I can. I kidded myself once upon a time before I was really into the industry that I might catch up and read all the Australian crime books. Now, of course, I know that they come out every week.
Yes, you should look at my office.
But, you know, over decades, though, putting Australia aside, over decades, like a lot of people, I've been a big fan of Lee Child and Robert Crace and Michael Connelly, the three C's. I've been the person that gets them every Christmas. The Jack Reacher character is fabulous fun, and that's been inspiring as well. And yeah. Michael Connelly, the crisp way he writes, he's a former journalist. It just, every page sings. He's brilliant. So, yeah, I do really, I admire those US bestsellers as well. And Karen Slaughter, she's amazing. She's
that's
literary.
Her real name. She actually has her surname.
I know, how lucky
Slaughter.
Are you to have that name? Look at the name I've been burdened with, and she's got Slaughter, Karen Slaughter. It's fantastic.
I did ask her, I interviewed her once online. I said, this isn't your real name. And she went, yeah. And there's a
destiny.
Clearly, yeah. What do they call it? Nominative determinism, or something like that. Something sort of philosophical. Any questions? Anything you want to ask, Michelle? Go ahead.
It's a very simple question. What do you do when you have writer's block?
Well, I try to plan out the whole book first, so I don't get writer's block. So I have less excuses for writer's block. So my plan might actually be, it's like I've got the chapter set out and every chapter has a few sentences describing what the heck's going to happen. So, you know, chapter one, Brex finds the abandoned resort. Chapter two, Erica does something. I've got a few sentences and that keeps me from writer's block because I know that I've already decided what's going to happen. I just have to do the work and just put in more detail so that the reader knows what's in my mind. And so, yeah, I find that that's defeated writer's block. For me, it's not... writer's block isn't the thing to fight against. It's just laziness. That's the thing to fight against. You know, if you would rather read, you know, a terrific book or put your feet up, there's a lot of things. Procrastination is the thing I'm continually fighting because I'm also a person that loves social media. But I've come to realise now, and I've talked about this on a podcast recently, I don't need to abandon social media. I've recognised that in the morning that's my warm-up, that I go to my desk and I'm warming up by looking at Instagram, looking at Twitter, looking at news websites. And once I've done that for 20 minutes or half an hour, then I'm ready to work. I try to fight it for a while, thinking, what are you doing, wasting time? But now I know it's just a process. And I'll start writing eventually that morning.
And you don't need to return to it?
I mean, just social
to return to your social media to look at your feed?
Oh, no. If I do, it'll be, you know, at a lunch break or in the evening. Yeah. Once I'm in the book, I'm usually pretty compelled by it and really want to get that chapter done that day or whatever my goal is.
And you do, I mean, talking about social media, you do have... It's obviously present in the book, in the lives of these characters, because they're that kind of age. They couldn't not have social media.
Exactly. So social media is important to the characters.
Yeah. So not having a phone is a disaster. If they don't have their phone, it's...
Oh, no, that's right. Oh, yeah. It's really bad. Your battery's running low. You're dying.
Yeah, but also, when you live in a shell of a building, you're not going to be able to charge your phone there. So, that's a bit of a risk. Sorry, other questions?
Michelle, are any of the characters in your book?
No, they're not. None of them are based on people I know. I feel like I conjure them myself. Maybe I'm kidding myself, but I feel like they're just characters that I create. However, there are elements that I borrow from people that I know and people in my life. So, for example, you know, Max bodybuilding. My youngest son is a bodybuilder. So I just wanted to have that. I thought it was really interesting. That hobby is so interesting. I would never do it. I haven't walked into a gym in 15 years. So I borrow sometimes a hobby or a passion, I suppose, just to add some colour. I'm inspired by pieces of people around me, but I wouldn't say I ever based characters on anyone I know.
Possibly situations.
Yeah, possibly situations as well, yeah, especially with my background. Okay.
We can hear, so I can always repeat.
Fickle.
Yeah, we can repeat the question.
I work in
Does
very...
Does Michelle work in her pyjamas?
Very daggy tracksuit pants, like a lot of writers. It's one of the perks of the job.
And I have a daughter in Adelaide, which I think and I'm not sure what the name is like, but on that blurry of the image, place called Character Link.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't know that, that beautiful, fast, gorgeous. And also know those rather dodgy southern on that train line.
Yeah.
Beyond, you know, south.
Oh, terrific. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. So
you know what I'm putting down.
So what you're saying really is this is true to life. Because you've just been there and you know that it's and there is a huge pleasure. I don't know if that if you feel it, but do you like reading books set in Sydney? I love it because you know it. You've walked down that street. You've done that. Or in London, I've lived in London as well. There's always something slightly special. So, yeah, that's you've got that right.
You know, it's a lovely part of the world. And Karrakalinga Beach that you've mentioned, that's gorgeous, and that is right on that strip that I'm basing this on. Yeah.
Anybody else want to find out a bit more? I really encourage you to read the book in that it will keep you tense.
Awake.
Well, awake in your case, and tense. But it is not in any way gratuitously violent.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of violent incidents. But that, I think, is a real art. And it is very much based in how we're living and what we're living now. So it was great to have Michelle at Bad Sydney a couple of years ago with Rush, the Rush. And sadly, she can't come this year, but at least I've had the chance to talk to you now.
Yeah, I'm really grateful. It's fantastic. My own spin-off event.
That's right. You're a small bad just for Michelle. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you very much, Michelle.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you so much. Thank you.
And there are some books, so do feel that you can grab a book and get Michelle to sign it just for you.